It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says that the young people at the forefront of the Never Again movement are disrupting traditional gun control politics and changing the conversation. First, in the 2016 elections, Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin by nearly 23,000 votes. Senator Ron Johnson defeated Russ Feingold by about 100,000. According to Attorney General Brad Schimmel, those results might not have happened if it weren't for the state's voter ID law. He made the remark last week on WISN Radio in Milwaukee.
How many of your listeners really honestly are sure that Senator Johnson was going to win re-election or President Trump was going to win Wisconsin if we didn't have voter ID to keep Wisconsin's elections clean and honest and have integrity?
Governor Scott Walker weighed in on the issue yesterday, saying the wins by Trump and Johnson came down to good, hard campaigning.
I think the president really connected, particularly with a lot of people in the state who felt like they had not been touched nationally, at least by leaders from either political party. And I think that more than anything were the reasons why those elections went the way they did.
Under the voter ID law, voters have to show a photo ID at the polls. Republicans argue that the measure was needed to prevent election fraud. Democrats say it suppresses the votes of low-income and minority voters. The State Elections Commission said municipal clerks reported 73 instances of possible fraud in all of 2016. Of those, 21 were tied to the November election, with about half of those having to do with someone trying to vote twice. So do Trump and Johnson have voter ID to thank for their victories? David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. His areas of expertise include election administration and elections. David, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Well, what was your reaction to Attorney General Schimmel's comment that voter ID might have been part of the story in those election wins?
Well, so there are two ways that you could interpret what he said. So what clearly he meant was that if we didn't have the voter ID law, that there would have been massive fraud that would have potentially denied both Donald Trump and Ron Johnson their election wins. But that completely flies in the face of everything we know about voter impersonation fraud. There have been dozens and dozens of studies all over the country, and typically you find in the single digits out of millions of vote casts in terms of voter impersonation fraud, even potential voter impersonation fraud. And then you do get a few cases of people voting twice, but always, again, maybe 10 cases out of millions of votes cast. And so in no way can you get the 99,000 votes or nearly 23,000 votes, the margin of victory for Johnson and Trump. So the second interpretation then is the one that most people are putting on this, which is that if you look back at the what actually was happening when they passed this law, it was intended to try to keep down voter turnout in Milwaukee in areas with more Democratic voters. There was testimony in the federal district court case, the Frank versus Trump, where you had a Republican longtime staffer for Dale Schultz testify that the Republican legislators in the closed meeting on this were saying that the reason to do this was to try to keep down the student vote and keep down vote in Madison and Milwaukee. And so this is what I think people are calling a Kinsley gap, which is when a politician tells the truth, but the truth is something they weren't supposed to say. And so the truth is that this clearly did dampen the Democratic vote in some of those key areas. Now, we don't know for sure whether or not enough votes were prevented to actually be that margin of victory. And so what we do know for sure is that it did hurt turnout, and disproportionately affecting groups of voters that do tend to vote more Democratic than Republican.
Do we know that well enough to take it to the bank to say, yes, votes are actually suppressed by voter ID laws like the one we have in Wisconsin?
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, the testimony in the federal district court, they had several experts in the case, that one that showed that there were about 300,000 people in the state of Wisconsin that didn't have the voter ID necessary to be able to vote under Wisconsin law. And then there was additional testimony that the effort to provide the free ID also was being conducted in a way such that that people, even who entered into the process, still were not able to produce documents to be able to get the free ID. And so that was something that was changed in the court order that did make it so that you could get a temporary document to allow you to vote. And so we don't know for sure how many of those potential 300,000 people who didn't have IDs then ended up not even trying to vote. We have some evidence from a survey that my colleague Ken Mayer did, and they found that up to about 10% of the people who reported not voting in Milwaukee ended up saying that they were at least deterred to some extent by the voter ID law. Now, actually, how many votes that turns into, it's really hard to say for sure. You'll never know if how many of those 22,000 vote margin for Trump would have been potentially affected by the voter ID law. But we can say for sure that there were at least thousands of voters at a minimum who didn't vote in the election because of the voter ID law.
We're talking to David Cannon from UW-Madison looking at voter ID, voter fraud, and voter suppression. Let's turn back to the fraud side of things. David, you mentioned voter impersonation fraud. That would be the one kind of voting fraud that an ID requirement would stop, right?
That's right. And so, if you're trying to vote in someone else's name, a voter ID definitely would prevent that from happening. But that's the type of voter fraud that's almost certainly the least common. We've had some evidence in other states of people who weren't citizens voting in state elections, and that isn't allowed in any state. And so that's something that isn't caught by a voter ID, though, because you don't have to be a citizen to have a driver's license. And so that's a type of fraud that wouldn't be caught by a voter ID law.
And some of the fraud that is detected in Wisconsin that was in 2016 is voting or trying to vote in two different locations. That also wouldn't be prevented by voter ID. Is that correct?
Well, correct. Yeah. So that can be detected later. If you compare the voter registration records, you should be able to pick up that voting twice in one election in different locations. But that too, if you have a valid ID and you're on the rolls, or you can register with documents saying you live one place and you go and you register again with documents saying you live at another place, that's going to be allowed by a voter ID. Again, if the system is working properly, you should be able to catch those types of double votes, but the voter ID itself will not prevent that.
Is there some kind of, and this might be hard to measure, is there some kind of deterrent effect where if someone who's thinking of voting fraudulently knows that there's a voter ID law in place, some kind of well-publicized election security law in place, they might think, well, however I was going to try to vote fraudulently, it sounds like they're on their game, I'm going to not try to commit this crime.
Well, yeah, that's something obviously is very hard to detect. A deterrent effect like that is hard to detect in a law. I would say that probably the bigger deterrent effect than a voter ID would be the careful examination of voter registration records to make sure that people aren't registered in multiple places. And that's something that I think Wisconsin always has done a pretty good job of, is maintaining voter rolls to make sure they're accurate and up to date. That's probably the best thing that can be done at the election administration level to prevent voter fraud as opposed to a voter ID law.
I want to turn to this November's elections. Attorney General Schimmel is up for re-election. He'll be facing Democrat Josh Call, it looks like, who's an attorney who has represented groups in lawsuits challenging the voter ID law here in the state. To the extent that people pay attention to the Attorney General's race, is voter ID going to be an issue here?
Well, it could be, but in general, voter ID laws are quite popular. That this is something that the governor, Governor Walker, has talked about, and Brad Schimmel has talked about. That this is a popular law overall, and not just in Wisconsin, but nationally. Voters do tend to think this is a good idea by fairly substantial majorities in most states where they've done polls on this. And I think most voters just don't know how many people don't have IDs, that they think, oh, well, I need a ID to get on an airplane. I need an ID to do so many things in my life. I can't imagine there are people who don't have an ID. But yet there are 300,000 Wisconsin potential voters who don't have IDs. And that's something I think that just isn't widely known. But because most people themselves aren't affected by a law like this because they do have IDs, they think, yeah, it's a good idea to have an ID to improve the integrity of elections. There's very low cost to this. I just, take out my billfold, show my ID. It's no big deal. But it's a huge deal to people who don't have those IDs. And so for, every, one vote of potential fraud that's prevented, there are probably at least 1,000 people who end up not being able to vote because of it. So it's a really not comparable kind of effect here in terms of looking at the impact on democracy and the ability of people to have their voice heard in the democratic process. But to the extent this becomes an issue, I think that Josh Call is going to have to make it an issue, because right now it's one that clearly favors the Republican Party, because these are popular laws in general.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
That's David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison. We talked to him about voter ID, voter fraud, and voter suppression in Wisconsin. Coming up, our guest says that the Never Again movement is fundamentally changing the way we talk about gun control. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says when we're online, we should think before we like. He shares advice on navigating social media when we want to be conscious, safe, and aware of our media consumption habits. Right now, after the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida, young people have been the most visible advocates for gun control. They're also talking about the issue in new ways. Our next guest says that by using unapologetic rhetoric and bringing racial issues into the discussion, those in the Never Again movement are bringing new life to the gun control movement. George Zornick is the Washington editor for The Nation. His recent cover story for the magazine is called How the Never Again Movement is Disrupting Gun Politics. George, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, you write that one of the major ways the Never Again movement, led by students from the school in Florida, you say they're changing the conversation about guns by talking about race and including people of color who have been affected by these issues. Talk about how that's working.
Yeah, there's always been this kind of disconnect or awkwardness about the gun control discussion that we've had over the past few years, because it really sprang up only after the Newtown shooting. So as I'm sure you remember, for many years, Democrats were loath to talk about gun control of any kind. There were not the kind of big, heavy-hitting gun control groups here in Washington up until the Newtown shooting, give or take. And that shooting very understandably galvanized a lot of people into action. All of a sudden, President Obama became this gun control crusader after not mentioning it. I mean, he literally never mentioned gun control at all while he was running for president in 2012. So the awkwardness about that was that, for many years or decades, gun violence had been claiming the lives of Black and Brown Americans without much of a peep from Washington and from politicians. But all of a sudden they were galvanized by some of these mass shootings that were happening in suburban schools and shopping malls and movie theaters. And no question those were horrific events, and no question that a lot of the people who have been pushing for gun control care about it in all aspects. But the fact of the matter is that if you are a Black American, you are 13 times more likely to be killed by a gun than a white American. And that was something that was just kind of missing from the gun control dialogue. So what's so interesting to watch about these kids from Parkland is they've really taken that head on. So not just as an aside or as a kind of a throat clearing to talking about the mass shooting that they experienced, but they, if you watch the March for Lives, they had a lot of people from Chicago and from here in D.C., who had experienced gun violence routinely in their communities. I covered an event here in Washington before the march, which got a ton of media coverage. The Parkland kids came up a few days early and they went to a high school here in Southeast Washington that experiences quite a bit of gun violence. In fact, this school was only 400 students, and two students had been killed this year since classes began in September by gun violence. And so they were trying to highlight that, look, this is not just a problem that we periodically have to deal with when a mass shooting comes up on the news. It's something that Americans are living every day in certain areas, and that's something we have to confront head on.
Well, I want to give a listen to that event, students from Parkland and students from the Thurman Marshall Academy in Washington, D.C. Here's a listen to Lauren Renford from Thurman Marshall and David Hogg from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School.
The students from Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School lost 17 members of their community in one deadly shooting. We have too lost just as many friends and family members to gun violence. It is our shared grief of our loved ones that we stand united in this call to action.
The media focus on school shootings and oftentimes be biased towards white privileged students. Many of these communities are disproportionately affected by gun violence, but they don't get the same share of media attention that we do.
Talk about that media attention. There's been some criticism that students of color have been advocating on these issues in the past. I haven't gotten the attention that the Never Again movement at Parkland from Parkland has.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been a little bit of an undercovered aspect of the Black Lives Matter movement that we have seen spring up in the past few years, which certainly has been covered, although I would say not quite to the degree and not with the uniform positivity that the Parkland kids have. But their critique was not just the violence that they experienced at the hands of police officers, but the daily grind of violence that was affecting their neighborhoods. And so, you know, I think David Hogue and his colleagues from Parkland were wise to point that out. You know, I was at that rally, and there was a little bit of an awkward situation where, you know, David Hogue had given that great speech and delivered that line that we just heard, and then he had to leave a little bit early because he had a packed schedule, and the crush of media cameras kind of followed him out of the auditorium while the Thurgood Marshall students were still talking. So surely it's not going to be you know, an overnight lesson, but I do think the conversation is starting to shift towards really people really understanding how many lives are taken every day in this country by guns and who is disproportionately affected by that violence.
George Zornick is with us, Washington editor for The Nation, talking about his piece, How the Never Again Movement is Disrupting Gun Politics. In addition, George, to covering racial issues, you say that the rhetoric is different and kind of more cuts to the chase than a lot of traditional gun control activism.
Yeah, so, you know, like I say, what's so important to understand about the gun control movement is that it's so young and really in its current form, born after Newtown. And what that meant was that it was naturally going to be kind of small C conservative and consensus building to start, because it came about in a moment where you had a president that was willing to sign gun control legislation. You had a Senate that was controlled by Democrats, though they lacked 60 votes. And then a House that was controlled by Republicans, but the polls said that people want some of these things like background checks and smaller magazines. So the movement, when it was born right after Newtown, was immediately focused on like, okay, what are the trade-offs here? What can we immediately get through this system, which is controlled by both Republicans and Democrats and pro-gun politicians and people who favor gun control. So it was always going to be natural that once Barack Obama left office and was replaced by Donald Trump, who absolutely under no circumstances will sign any kind of major gun control legislation, that the movement was going to start to expand its horizons. They were going to stop talking about just what can we get through the House of Representatives with 219 votes or whatever, and thinking about, well, what are the maximalist positions that would really change the tide of stem the tide of gun violence in this country. So I think people expected that, but they did not expect that on top of that, the biggest advocates for gun control are these kids, which have just cut through the dialogue in such an interesting way, in part because I think they understand social media and media writ large in a way that a lot of adults don't. And I include myself in that. I mean, I'm 35 years old, but I am amazed by what some of these kids have been able to do on social media and the way that they've changed the conversation. And I think too, there's this interesting mix of like, and I don't mean this as a criticism at all, but you know, you're 17, 18, you think that you have kind of the solutions to all the problems that you see, and you're not afraid to just say, this is what should be done and this is what we need to do. And I think the gun control movement was lacking that. And so I think that's in one way they've given it such a huge boost.
Do you see this movement having an impact, maybe not at the federal level yet, but in actual legislation at the state level?
Yeah, I think that's always been the story of gun control post-Newtown, is that, federal change more or less remains elusive. But at the state level, particularly after these mass shootings, there has been some movement. I mean, even down in Florida, you know, that's a state legislature controlled by Republicans, heavily influenced by the NRA. They passed some measures after the Parkland, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting. Certainly not what the activists were pushing for, not a full accounting of that, but, you know, things that the NRA really didn't want, like raising the age for when you can purchase a weapon and strengthening some of the background check system there. So little by little, I think they're chipping away, and gun control activists understand, I think, that it's a marathon, not a sprint. It's not going to happen overnight, but by state by state kind of getting the change that they want, and on the national level kind of starting a more fulsome discussion about gun violence and what needs to be done, that they'll eventually get there. I don't mean to keep saying this, but look, the gun control movement really, as it exists now, is just, it's a very young movement here since early 2013. So I think too early to say, oh, they haven't achieved anything yet. I mean, I think they will.
What makes the difference between whether Never Again is in this debate for a marathon or in it for a sprint and then it kind of fades away?
Well, you know, part of it is just, as you know from covering the news, particularly now in the age of Donald Trump, there's like six insane things happening at a time. I mean, last week there were like four or five stories that in any other time period that I remember would be huge, like 6 month long affairs. So they're kind of up against fighting for space and attention. Some of the grim calculus of the gun control movement is that mainly they are spurred on by mass shootings. And so there's been this terrible cycle of, you know, horrific violence, a few news cycles, some legislative change, and then it all recedes into the background, frankly, whether Trump is president or not. And then it comes back. And what's so interesting about what these kids are doing is the way that they're trying to really build an activist movement that is not de facto dependent on, you know, mass shootings to capture people's attention. I mean, at the March for Our Lives here in D.C., and I know the ones across the country, there was a very concentrated effort to register voters and get them out to the polls. They're building out the kind of activist networks that you see in other movements that I think they hope at least will be sustainable and kind of immune to the news cycle.
George, thanks for joining us today.
So good to be with you.
That's George Zornick, Washington editor for The Nation. We've been talking about his piece there called How the Never Again Movement is Disrupting Gun Politics. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how House Speaker Paul Ryan's departure could impact the Republican Party in Congress and what it means for Wisconsin's 1st congressional district. First, many people check social media apps on their phone several times a day without even realizing they're doing it. It's becoming an unnoticed habit, and it may be time to consider if it's a habit worth keeping. On the flip side, for those who are very light social media users or new to the networks, figuring out the unspoken social rules and hidden ad placements can be pretty confusing. Guy Harrison is a writer, reporter, and advocate for Science and Reason. His latest book is called Think Before You Like, Social Media's Effect on the Brain and the Tools You Need to Navigate Your Newsfeed. Guy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Great to be with you, man.
Well, Guy, you go through a lot of the ins and outs of social media. Big picture, and you've been thinking about this as you wrote the book. Social media, good or evil?
Impossible to answer one or the other, because it's both. It really is both. I mean, on one hand, social media is just such a pure expression of our humanity. You know, we are social creatures. We connect, we communicate. That's what we do. That's what allowed us to kind of rise up out of the jungle and build all these great civilizations, you know, networking, passing information, sharing. That's how we do it. So yeah, it's part of us. It's who we are. But then the dark side, the bad side, is that, of course, just like everything else we come up with, it's great. You know, we kind of twist it and turn it in ways that can really harm us. You know, it's like probably 5 minutes after the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk, I'm sure somebody said, hey, we can use that airplane thing to kill people. It's just who we are.
One of the biggest issues out there lately has been how our data is used. The Cambridge Analytica story hitting Facebook is the latest example of that. But that's been a worry for advertisers, for our privacy, things like that. It's something we have to consider when we go online. What do you think about when you are online when it comes to how all the stuff out there about you is going to get used.
Yeah, that's a big thing in my book, Think Before You Like. I just constantly push the theme of people must be aware. That's the first step. You have to understand that everything you do on the web, everywhere you go, it's all being just harvested, recorded, saved by somebody somewhere. And nobody's required to tell you. Nobody's required to dump it after a certain amount of time. I mean, it just gets passed around. Who knows where your footprints end up? And you got to be aware of that. And when you really confront that reality, and when you think about it, you don't have to panic and, you know, go live in a log cabin in the woods off the grid forever or anything. You can still use the internet, use social media. But that simple awareness is the first step towards really making you a more savvy, sensible, safer user. Because generally people just share too much, and they're just way too open, and they're just giving away so much. And for give you a real quick example, Rob, I was at a tea shop, and this guy asked me that work there. He says, hey, why don't you get the app? You get a discount every time. And this is while I was writing this book. And I said, sure, I'll check it out. And I went to the website, looked at the app, and then I actually read the terms of agreement, which no one ever does, of right. course, but I read it. And I was shocked, you know, this simple little app, so you can get a, you know, 5% off on your tea or coffee or whatever. If I agreed to it, it would allow access through my smartphone to all of my text messages, every photo I take or ever had taken, all emails, all my contacts, all that stuff, just so I can get a little bit off on a tea, you know, a cup of tea. Is that really worth it? I don't think so. You know, these apps, the reason all this stuff is free, social media, the apps and all that, it's all free because you're not paying with money, you're paying with your life, your privacy. That's what they're taking, and they're using that. They're either selling that or allowing advertisers they make money off to target you more precisely.
But is that just the price of admission? If we want to play on, say, Facebook, and I'm looking at your book here with more than 2 billion users, or Tumblr with 550 million, or lots in between, bigger and smaller, if we want to join this part of human sociability, that's what they require of us. How do we make that decision?
Yeah, well, you're definitely going to give up some privacy if you play in the social media playground at all. But here's the thing. If you're a little bit smart about it, if you don't give away everything, and if you always keep in the back of your mind that a potential employer, a potential romantic interest, somebody in my future who matters to me may see this one day, it might give you that little moment of pause before you tweet some horrible emotional reaction to something, or before you post that picture of you, you know, running around in your underwear at the party or something on Facebook. You know, before you do that, you might want to think the possible consequences through, because this stuff does have implications for jobs, you know, the apartment you want to rent. It's amazing. There are right now companies which offer their services to big corporations, help them hire. Whereas a company, you know, right now in the U.S., an HR person in a job interview cannot ask a job candidate what their religion is, are they liberal, conservative, what's their position on hunting or abortion or something like that. But they don't have to, because it's all there on social media. And these firms will actually crunch your social media presence, your footprint throughout the internet, and just give a score, just hand over a score to this a company that may be interested in hiring you. And based on that score, you may or may not even get a call to come in and interview for the job, and you'll never know why. You know, that's how serious this stuff is. And just simply knowing this, I'm not condemning social media. I'm not saying everybody needs to get off it immediately, but wow, you must be aware.
Guy Harrison is with us. We're talking about his book, Think Before You Like, Social Media's Effect on the Brain, the Tools You Need to Navigate Your Newsfeed. Let's talk about that brain a little bit, Guy, and the idea, the question of whether the internet, social media is addictive, or at least a compulsion, habit forming. How do we manage our time and attention that we pay to social media?
Yeah, there's some controversy with that. The whole internet addiction, the social media addiction thing, everybody throws that word addiction around. But actually, within the medical community, there's disagreement. Some people say it's not a real thing. Others say, oh, yes, it is. You know, and I've got the patients to prove it. So, yeah, right now, it's such a new thing that many health professionals are still coming to grips with it. And, you know, I talk to experts, I've looked through many studies, and the conclusion I came to that it's bad. Social media is bad for you if it's bad for you. And if it's not, it's not. And what I mean by that is some people can use social media 40 hours a week. They can be on it hours and hours a day, and they have fine, happy, productive lives. They don't skip a beat. Other people, 2 hours a day could devastate their life. It could ruin their marriage. It could make them forget to pick up the kids after school. So yeah, it really is sort of a eye of the beholder thing. You know, you got to watch out. Same with alcohol. I mean, some people drink a little and have all kind of problems. Some people drink heavily and still function well in society. So yeah, you've got to really look at it from a very personal standpoint. Are you giving up too much time? Are you sacrificing, compromising your life in areas that are important to you or should be important? You got to really step back and assess. And there's great apps in the book. I give recommendations for apps, free apps. Here I go recommending an app. There's a contradiction. But there's apps that will monitor your social media use. And that can be eye-opening. I mean, at the end of the week, you look and you go, whoa, wait a minute. I spent 30 hours on Facebook? What? You know, that's another job, a full-time job almost. So yeah, there's ways around this. But yeah, bottom line, I would say take it seriously, because we are creatures of habit, and we can easily get hooked on something like, you know, social media, and it could cause problems in your life, especially when these social media companies are doing everything possible to hook you and keep you stuck on those screens and coming back as often as possible. They pay, you know, smart people a lot of money to figure out how to design those little screens with the little bells and whistles to excite your little subconscious mind.
We're talking to Guy Harrison. His new book is Think Before You Like: Social Media's Effect on the Brain and the Tools You Need to Navigate Your News Feed. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, and questions for our guest. What are your social media concerns? Do you have a social media habit, a routine? Do you feel like you use it too much? Have you made a conscious decision to quit or at least scale back your use of Facebook and other social media sites? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Guy Harrison about his new book. It's called Think Before You Like: Social Media's Effect on the Brain and the Tools You Need to Navigate Your Newsfeed. Call 800-642-1234 to join the conversation. Has social media had a positive impact or negative impact on your life? Do you feel like social connection on social media is really sociable, or is it missing something if you're not seeing people for real? Or, as some people say, does social media lead to those in-person contacts? How do you use it? Have you felt like someone you know is hooked on it, whether we call that addicted or not? Have you cut back on Facebook or other social media? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Guy, you also write about our sort of filter bubble, some people call it, the bubble of like-minded people we can surround ourselves on, all the more so on social media. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's a huge problem. It always has been, though. It's become such an obvious thing with social media. Basically, what a filter bubble is that you just sort of intellectually dwell in this zone where the only news you read is the kind of stuff that you agree with already, and the only kind of humans you interact with are people who agree with you on everything. And so it's a comfortable place, and it gives you a reassuring world, you know, reassures you that your worldview is correct all the time, no matter how crazy it may be. And it's a real problem, because one of the best things about a human mind is that it is just built for constant learning throughout life. And when you're in a filter bubble, you're not really learning. You're not really challenging yourself. You're not really thinking. You're just sort of treading water. You know, you're not getting anywhere. And so I have a whole chapter on this. It's such a serious challenge. What I recommend people is, you know, broaden your base, interact with people who do not agree with you. And yeah, it can be a challenge. Believe me, I know it can be, but you need to do it. You can't just hang out with clones of yourself all day. It's not going to be beneficial for you. It's not going to be stimulating. And plus you need to hear the other side of the argument, no matter how obviously wrong it is. You got to listen, because the thing is, with our brains, we've got all these subconscious biases that just set us up. You know, confirmation bias is a big one. So we're always collecting, we're always noticing and emphasizing and remembering data, arguments that agree with our beliefs. And we're always just kind of not hearing or forgetting data, conclusions, comments that somehow contradict our beliefs. So we're always building up these lopsided cases in our head that make our worldview obviously true. And the way you give yourself a more realistic worldview is you got to look at the other, you got to give the other side a fair hearing, and you got to interact with diverse people. You got to hear those other opinions. That is crucial. And a good thing about social media is that you can do that. You know, don't block everyone who disagrees with you. Don't only seek out people that are just like you in every way. You want to mix it up. That doesn't mean you necessarily have to go friend 50 neo-Nazis or something just so you can feel diverse. But somewhere before that, you can really mix it up good, and it'll be to your intellectual good health.
What's tricky is we can end up with a bubble without even consciously trying to create it. If I, you know, share stories on, I don't know, the Green Bay Packers, then all the algorithms on Google and Facebook, they're going to start forwarding me Packer stories. I didn't make a decision to not interact with Vikings fans, but once I made those first steps, it just sort of naturally happened without my being conscious of it.
I'm so glad you said that, Rob. That's one of the key problems with social media as it exists today, because they've set up these algorithms to keep you on it, to keep you happy and hooked and coming back. And the way they figure you do that is just give people what they want. Okay. And what you want is not always what you need. You know, if you're a flat earth believer, then you're going to be really happy if all you get is little ads about flat earth books and YouTube links about how flat earth is reality and all this kind of stuff. And you're getting all these fringe suggestions, people who also believe in the flat earth, then you're going to be, you know, really happy with your social media experience and keep coming back. So that's what they want. You know, Facebook doesn't care how many people believe in a spherical planet. They care about how many people they got coming back to Facebook every day. So those algorithms are designed to feed you what you want. That's one of the biggest problems with social media, because we should be challenging ourselves. We should be using this to grow and to expand our networks and to expand our minds and our knowledge base. That's the real beautiful potential of social media and the internet, that we can connect with people we otherwise wouldn't, not to just create these more rigid tribal boundaries around us. That's one of the great challenges of social media we need to straighten out.
Do you think those rigid tribal boundaries are spreading out into the real world? Is this informing how we think about politics, science, whatever?
Yeah, I think so. I really do. And I'm not fatalistic about it or anything. I think things will get better. But yeah, right now we're kind of in a bad place. I mean, it's so easy now. I think we're seeing this explosion of conspiracy theories and all this stuff. And they've always been around. But wow, they're just getting so much attention now. I read something the other day, something like a third of millennials are skeptical of whether or not the earth is round. I mean, I don't know if that's an accurate poll, but that's pretty disturbing. I mean, I am sure that is directly the cause, you know, can be directly pinned on YouTube videos and things they read on social media, you know. So yeah, we've got to tweak the formula here. We got to figure out how these social media companies can make all their billions so they're happy, without manipulating our minds and steering us all into these little weird tribes apart from one another.
I want to go to our callers now at 800-642-1234 as we talk to Guy Harrison about his new book, Think Before You Like. Bill is with us in Madison. Bill, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you think?
Well, I was thinking of listening to him talking that, you know, interacting with social media over a computer is not interacting. I think you have to be face-to-face if you want to interact with somebody. You have no idea whether it's, well, I mean, let's just say Facebook, you could be talking to a computer for all you know. So that's my two cents worth.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. And a lot of people have this concern, Guy, that yeah, we think we're interacting and socializing. We're missing some serious stuff that we really need.
Yeah, the great comment right there. Thank you, Bill. Yeah, two things. One, many times you are talking to a machine and not a human being, whether you know it or not. And two, I touch on this in the book, that social media can be great if it connects you to other human beings, but not just digitally, but gets you in their presence, you know, connect with people, form a hiking group or a stamp collecting club, you know, online, but actually meet as well physically if you can. That's the real beauty of it. Because I tell you, we're, as humans, I mentioned earlier, we're social creatures, you know, we're primates, we thrive, we need that close, intimate connection with our own kind. And as the digital world exists now, it does not satisfy that. It teases it. It's sort of a diluted substitute for it, but it is definitely not a replacement. You will never be happy and content mentally if you are only interacting with people online. You need to be in the physical presence of people.
Thanks for that call, Bill. We heard from Matt in Wausau, who emails, social media exposed us for what we really are, like it or not. Do you agree with that guy that whatever's bad on social media is just, you know, a reflection of what we are? Or is there something unique about social media that maybe amplifies some of the worst things in us?
Well, there's, yeah, it goes both ways. I mean, yeah, social media is a human creation. It's an expression of us. There's no Martians, you know, posting stuff on Facebook. So, yeah, this is all human. This is humanity. Raw and unplugged right here before you, good and bad. But that said, we still have to also be aware that there are corporations, there are governments around the world that are using social media to just blatantly manipulate people. I mean, things going on. There's one example I give in the book about a Facebook document, executive document leaked, that was just really disturbing. It was in Australia. They were offering to advertisers to serve up targeted advertising to teenagers who were in the moment suffering extreme emotional stress, and they were distraught about their weight or maybe feeling suicidal and all that. And they were going to allow, I don't think it went through because it all came out and they got in trouble about it, but they were actually seemed to be poised to, you know, allow help advertisers target extremely vulnerable young people, you know, an emotional crisis to do what? I mean, think about it. I'm not saying Facebook was doing this, but think about how bad that could be. You could have a gun company's, you know, putting ads right there in front of the screen in front of some 13-year-old who's having suicidal thoughts. And you could say, hey, cheap handgun for sale here or something. I mean, it's just amazing. I give many, many examples in the book of how many people are manipulated in ways they don't know. For example, real quick, I won't ramble too much, but Google searches. You search something in a low-income zip code, if you're, say, a young person, teenager, you'll get ads for the military. Join the Army today, you know, see the world, join the Navy. And a person the same age in the same country, United States, in a wealthier zip code, does a Google search for the same exact topic. They'll see ads coming up around in the, you know, as they surf around, they'll see ads coming up. You know, consider going to Princeton, you know, college is for you. Here's how you can get financial aid. So it's almost nudging their destiny along, you know, at that young age. I mean, that's not right.
Briefly, Guy, you have a top 16 list of the most used social media sites. I've heard of about 10 of them. Social media is a moving target. What we're talking about now might be different in 1 year. Is it hard for us, our minds, very briefly as we wrap up, to keep up with this changing landscape?
Yeah, it really is. You can't keep up with it. It's changing too fast. And just wait and see. Virtual reality is right around the corner. Facebook's investing billions in it. It's going to be, oh my gosh, if we think we have addiction problems now, oh my gosh, you ain't seen nothing yet. So yeah, the best advice I can offer people is be aware, be careful with your data. You know, I have a whole chapter on security. Use smart passwords. Public Wi-Fi, there's just things you have to be aware of. There's a short checklist, maybe 10 or 15 things every human on the planet should be aware of when on the internet, on social media. You want to protect yourself, protect your data, and you want to pay some attention to what's happening because it is a changing landscape.
Thanks to Guy Harrison. We've been talking about his latest book. It's called Think Before You Like, Social Media's Effect on the Brain and the Tools That You Need to Navigate Your Newsfeed. Beer and cheese are big parts of the Wisconsin economy, and they both rely on the magical microorganism called yeast. So if there's no yeast, there's no cheese, and there's no beer. And according to a new study from scientists in France, it looks like all that yeast ultimately comes from one place. So a big thank you to China. The French researchers collected yeast samples from all over the world, hundreds of them, and then they sequenced their genomes. I'm not just talking about yeast in food, beer, and wine, but wild yeast, yeast they found in horse dung, human blood, a rotting banana, and seawater. By comparing and contrasting their samples, they were able to figure out where the yeast was most diverse, which is usually a good sign of where a species came from. And all roads lead to China. The idea is that wild yeast evolved there in China, then spread around the world, and they think it may have been domesticated a whole bunch of different times in different places to make the food and drink we know and love. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll dig into a related topic, how alcohol and dairy helped shape modern humans. In the meantime, raise a glass of wine, a stein of beer, or a slice of cheese to the wild yeast ancestors that made it all possible. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.